Okay, so as many of you likely know, the theme for tonight and this month is wise effort. How many people have attended a talk this month on wise effort already? Oh, great, great. How about online? Okay, many. How many enjoy contemplating effort? Could be honest. Okay, Cheryl. Okay. That was not a resounding vote of enthusiasm. I have really come around to enjoying this contemplation. And how I'd like us to think about it tonight, as I've been reflecting on it, is it possible to apply effort to direct our energies in a way that is ennobling rather than depleting? So remember, we're in the framework of the Four Noble Truths. And another way of thinking about the Four Noble Truths is that they're not static truths for us to believe in, but when we practice them directly, when we engage them, when we explore and experiment with them, they become ennobling. So perhaps we start to have a sense of ourselves beyond the constricting habitual habit patterns that so easily overtake much of our experience. I don't know how it has been for you in practice, but I kind of thought that I was all hindrances for quite a few years. I kind of thought that that was just my personality. I was kind of this slightly sluggish, despondent, cynical person. Until practicing and recognizing, oh, those are actually states that come and go, that I can get entangled and entrenched with, but they actually lift. They're not intrinsic to who I am. So, to start to get a little bit of space from what's happening in our minds, start to recognize that a whole other dimension and scope starts to become present. Right? So, ennobling effort. So, how do we make effort? Our minds all contain a whole range of skillful and unskillful. Perhaps you've noticed. Nobody is just one or the other. It is all a mix. So the four wise efforts, as they're talked about in this teaching, have to do with how we relate to the skillful and the unskillful elements of our minds. So the very first, most important aspect of that is to know what's happening. As it's happening, moment by moment. We can't do anything without that. Often, for those of us who like effort, like to plunge right ahead and kind of get in there and tinker. And we have to know what's happening before we know what kind of effort is skillful. It's always a balance between what's happening inside and what our aim is. So we have to get to know our minds really well, and we have to know kind of what our intention is or where this is leading. So the practice aims towards a deepening sense of freedom and awakening, right? So holding that in mind, however we conceive of that or hold that possibility for ourselves, our effort has to be in line with that, right? Heading in that direction. our efforts are not necessarily going to make us a more productive employee, right? Or more efficient, or a lot of the values that our culture assigns to effort might not make us more productive. Maybe it will. But wise effort is effort that's in line with working with our own minds in a skillful way that leads towards awakening or freedom. So that's the practice. But as we start, I think it's really helpful to recognize that this is emphasized a lot more in the Mahayana traditions, that this is actually a joyful endeavor, that this is actually an amazing kind of opportunity to practice. I know when I first heard the four wise efforts, so these are, and perhaps you've heard this map already, and I'll just go over it kind of briefly tonight, but I really want to have plenty of time for discussion. But when I first heard the teaching on the four right efforts, which are in terms of the unskillful movements of our mind, where to prevent the unskillful, unarisen movements of our mind, so prevent those unskillful states that have not yet arisen, abandon those that have already arisen, that are already here. And then with the skillful, we're encouraged to cultivate wholesome or skillful states that are not yet here and maintain ones that are here. So I would hear those four right efforts, and I would feel exhausted in just listening to them. This sounds like way too much work. Early in my practice, it was so helpful for me just to let my mind be, just to kind of leave it alone and let the noticing be enough. And so I kind of thought that was the setting, or that was the dial. Oh, I just leave it alone. Kind of like the poem says, I just let everything just happen on its own. And oftentimes that is really skillful and a very helpful approach. Unless you're sliding or being sucked into unskillful states over and over again, then there's a different kind of effort or energy that's needed. Anyway, when I first heard the four right efforts, I thought, I'm not doing that. That sounds like way too much. But I was coming really from a sense of being so tired of tinkering with myself, of making adjustments, of trying to be a little bit better at this, trying to like dial down on what seemed not quite so good, tired of the tinkering and the adjusting and the trying to be a little bit better. But really coming overall from a sense of kind of lacking in some way. So that all of the effort was aligned with that sense of lack. I just need to, get a little bit better here or change things over here. And that exhausted itself. But right effort or wise effort is not about that. It's not about constantly tinkering and making things just a little bit better, changing the dials in that way. It's actually meant to be kind of a joyful sort of discovery of our own potentials and capacities and range. So I think we're supposed to start from a baseline of, this is a really good thing that we're doing. To be sitting here in this room at all with any inclination that one wants to understand and deepen and cultivate and practice, that is a good starting place. And so to kind of recognize that and come from a place of how much we actually have versus how much we're lacking is such a helpful approach with effort. So I often tell this story, and I often reflect on the story when I find that practice has become kind of a grim, effortful chore. It's starting to feel like drudgery or rote or something that I have to work hard at, another thing I have to do. Ajahn Chah, one of the great meditation masters in the Thai forest tradition, if you've ever seen a picture of him, he's just this like vibrant, smiling being, just incredibly radiant and joyful. It's a smile that seems to like light up his whole face. And there's a wonderful story of him coming to IMS, Insight Meditation Society in Massachusetts. I think it was one of the first times he had come to the U.S. to teach. And he came and people were practicing very diligently, doing walking meditation on the lawn at IMS. So eyes down with their walking path, forward, stop, turn around, standing, lifting, placing, stepping, very diligent in terms of effort. And he would walk around to them as they're doing walking practice and look at them, look around. And at one point he came up to someone and said, "I hope you get better soon." because we can have this pervasive attitude of, I'm practicing with a sort of kind of sense of impoverishment, you know, a sense of my own, perhaps a sense of my own brokenness. And if that's the case, we need to exert a lot of effort to kind of course correct, or it feels as though we need to exert a lot of effort in order to course correct. And so what's been most true for me in my practice is that it needs, my relationship to effort needs to be refreshed and renewed all the time. It's, so we're in the last section of the Eightfold Path, right? So it starts with the wisdom section. Middle part is the ethical sensitivity and responsiveness. And the last part has to do with mind training. So what's actually happening in our own minds? Classically, it has to do with meditation, what we do when we meditate. So effort, mindfulness, and concentration or gatheredness are the three factors in this last piece. So how much effort does it take to be mindful? To remember that awareness is already present. How much effort does it take? But we're also involved with cultivating a mindfulness that is steady and more continuous. So that's where a lot of the skill comes in, is knowing what supports a greater steadiness, unification of mind, gatheredness. And we practice that on the cushion, where hopefully it's a little bit easier. But that also extends into all the circumstances of our lives. So we start from hopefully somewhat of a sense of that this is a very helpful and can be a joyful thing to do. And that this dance of effort changes all the time. We can't just set it once and forget about it. All right, that's my setting for effort. We can't do that. It's constantly shifting based on what's happening within us. How many people feel the same degree of energy inside that you did 10, 15, 20 years ago? Shifting all the time, shifting. The outer requirements, circumstances, needs around us are shifting all the time. So Bhikkhu Bodhi says, tuning one's efforts to one's abilities and capacities and to the task at hand. This is wise effort. In some cases, this entails an all-out effort, a wholehearted effort. In others, simple watchfulness. It depends on what's happening. Okay. So I want to just go through these four possibilities for working with the skillful and the unskillful, because I think it does round out how we relate to effort. So I know for me early on in practice, so again, the four are we're preventing, we're kind of guarding, preventing unwholesome, and then abandoning unwholesome when they're already present. I know for me early on, I kind of thought that the whole practice was just abandoning unwholesome. It was meeting unwholesome and trying to abandon it as much as possible. And we can think of the unwholesome here. It's a whole range of tendencies with flavors of greed, hatred, and delusion. So what's most recognizable for most of us when we're sitting and in daily life are the hindrances. Right? So these are these pairs, and many of us are all too familiar with these by now. But the pair of wanting and not wanting, which we can see happen again and again, wanting things to be a little bit better, not wanting some experience we're having, that can be very subtle, it can be very intense, overwhelming. Restlessness and sluggishness are the other two pairs. So I mentioned these a little bit during the sit, but we can notice as our energies fluctuate, some of us have a tendency towards restlessness and worry. That's where there's a lot of movement in the body, that feeling of just gotta move, can't sit here, have to do something. And it tends to feed a worried mind that goes around and around, that likes to fix and solve problems, has a difficult time settling. Anybody familiar with that? Right. So again, part of our human inheritance, not a personal flaw of yours. The sluggishness or the dullness and inertia, sometimes called sloth and torpor, are two other pairs of hindrances. Right? And so it's important to notice those fluctuations when we're working with effort. So we apply a very different kind of effort if we're agitated, spun up, there's a lot of energy pulsing through our system. Our effort looks very different in those states than when we're dull, tending towards complacency and apathy, right? So we need to have both the skill of being able to arouse energy when that's helpful, to be able to say when we're really slipping into inertia, into dullness, that kind of quicksand or sinking, the ability to say, hey, wait a minute, what's going on here, is really important to arouse a little bit of energy. And then the last hindrance is doubt. Right? Doubt can be that kind of unhelpful questioning that can be so undermining of all of our efforts. Doubt just continually questions, am I doing it right? Is this the right thing to be doing? Should I do this? Should I do that? I'm not sure. This doesn't seem right. So Doubt, instead of moving closer to experience, to investigate, doubt pulls back and tries to mentally figure it all out before we will take a step. Okay. So these hindrances are the main territory that we're working with when we talk about the unwholesome tendencies that arise. So we need skills, both in knowing what to do when they are full blown, but also in preventing them from arising in the first place. So this requires a little bit of strategy. Yeah. So sometimes this first right effort is called guarding or preventing. And this is what we do when we bring mindfulness fully into the body, fully into the senses. By doing that, we actually protect our mind by keeping awareness at the sense doors. It's a way of holding our minds so that we don't go into a lot of proliferation or creating a world. Right? So if we're staying just with the sound, just with the sensation in the body as it is, just with the warmth of my hands as they're touching each other, that can be a tremendous support from the whole complexity of the world that I'm concocting and creating moment to moment, about how I want it to be, how it should be, how I should be, how am I going to get out of this, everything. So one primary way that we can guard and protect our mind is by staying right there at the sense doors. Yeah. Right there, staying at a place where it's somewhat neutral. We don't go to places that are already agitated, but a place that is somewhat neutral so we can feel held. We can feel that kind of protective quality. It doesn't mean that we'll always stay fixed perfectly on our breathing, on, say, the sense of the ground underneath or of sound. Doesn't mean that we'll always stay perfectly connected with our object. But we're staying in the range or in the territory. So as I first started experimenting with this preventing, I realized that I actually had a lot more influence over my states than I realized at first. That there were a lot of adjustments that I could make that would help. So we recognize this often on retreat, or when we sit for longer periods. If you eat the lasagna, you'll be able to feel it right away. You will suffer for the next several hours while you're trying to sit there. Yeah, sloth and torpor will be present. So you see this. So I practiced a lot with being able to notice, oh, okay, the amount of food that I eat, the sleep that I get, or not, what I'm consuming in terms of media, how much movement I get, all of that affects, to some degree, the states that are arising. So again, it's a balance between constantly manipulating, shifting, changing, and knowing how we can skillfully help prevent unwholesome states from being present. We can start to know what our triggers are. Yeah. And to some degree, we can, not always, of course, but to some degree, we can steer around them and prevent papancha. So abandoning is the letting go of the unskillful states that are already here. They're already fully present. We're aware of them. And this is, again, where a lot of us find ourselves a lot of the time. So this is where we get to know the hindrances really well and get to know kind of the first whiff of them, so we can start to feel like the leaning forward when we're starting to want something that isn't present. We can start to notice the first movements of bracing or tensing or tightening around something unpleasant that's happening. We can start to notice the tracks that our mind starts to go down when we're making a case, yeah, for or against something. We can start to get a sense of what's moving through us at any given time. And we have some room to move and relate to those states. Ajahn Suchito, I heard recently say in a talk, have you ever noticed that the skillful states of mind are not ever relentless? You know, you're never haunted by generosity. Yeah, you're never plagued by loving kindness. Yeah, you're never, and I'm just kind of plagiarizing what he said, but you get the idea. You're never consumed by patience. Right? So we can get to know when we're in the grip of something unskillful, because it's going to feel bad. If we're really careful, there may be some payoff initially, but it's going to feel like it afflictive in some way. So that's the clinging mind that gets gripped by a state. So where I've noticed this, notice this in a lot of areas, but just one simple example is noticing that often the first moment, just waking up in the morning, often it's a moment of a lot of vulnerability. Have you noticed that with your own mind? My mind can often immediately get pulled into worry or negativity just the second after I wake up. Yeah. The second immediately the spin is starting, some kind of worry or negativity. So knowing that that's a tendency, for a long time in practice, I thought, okay, well, I just have to be with it. I just have to be with this unskillful state as it arises. And so I would just lay there and try to be with it. Yeah. Meanwhile, getting more and more sucked in, more and more spun around, more and more in a negative whirlpool. So what does the abandoning look like? In that moment, a lot of the preventing could look like planting seeds before going to bed about how I would like to wake up. A lot about going to bed. But once it's actually present, it's very skillful if we're caught in something to shift our posture. To just, especially if it's a more if it feels like we're being overtaken by it, shift the posture. So what's extremely helpful is, rather than sitting there feeling at the mercy of it, is just to get up. Get up. So now I know how helpful it is to just let that be kind of one swift movement in the morning. Yeah. Staying there too long is to be overcome. So just get right up. So anyway, a lot of this has to do with knowing our tendencies and having experimented with what's helpful. But being willing to not just set one setting on our effort and then leaving it. Sometimes the most helpful thing is, I'm just going to sit here with this. I'm not going to move. I'm not going to try to make anything different. I'm just going to sit here with this. That is often extremely helpful, but not always. But not always. So, sometimes the most courageous form of effort, skillful form of effort that we can exert, is to pause in the middle of an unskillful state. So we can't say this often enough. It's like the most simplest instruction, but the hardest when we're in the middle of something, to just pause and say, what's going on here? What's possible here in terms of changing course? But, you know, inertia isn't just staying still. Inertia often is staying in motion when we're used to being in motion. So that pause and not just carrying on business as usual, have to get to the next thing, but to be able to put down the phone, put down the next order of business, and really just say, okay, what is this? What am I cultivating here? So with this abandoning, it's the recognition that these many of these patterns are going to be with us for a long time. Yeah? And it's a simple recognition, and they can shift in an instant. Sometimes they do. So it's not a resigned, well, ho-hum, this is just who I am. Guess, you know, it's the recognition that these tendencies are deep, and practice is powerful. Practice is very powerful. But thinking that we have to get rid of them forms another layer of judgment and aversion. So it is abandoning, often is abandoning our clinging relationship to the state itself. Often it doesn't mean that the state goes away, but we let go of a kind of antagonistic relationship to it. So the last two with the skillful are often the ones that get neglected, right? So this is the cultivating the wholesome and maintaining the wholesome. And often these get forgotten in our practice, or they get overlooked as less powerful, or they aren't balanced. So what I like to encourage with these efforts is for them to be balanced with one another, right? So it's not, it isn't just this upward slog through the hindrances. It's a balanced effort. So we're encouraged to cultivate the wholesome. The Buddha said in many places, in many ways, it is possible to cultivate what's helpful and healthy. It is possible to let go of what is unhelpful and unhealthy. If it weren't possible, I wouldn't teach it. I wouldn't ask you to do it. So with this cultivating, the first thing we're always cultivating is awareness, remembering that awareness is present. We cultivate factors of awakening like interest, investigation, joy, tranquility, steadiness. We cultivate states like metta, loving kindness. We cultivate paramis like patience. We don't have to do them all at once. A lot of the cultivating is not drumming up something that isn't present, making ourselves feel something we're not feeling. It's remembering an intention. Yeah. Remembering an intention and also reflecting on places where we have already been skillful. So this goes a long way in just remembering our intention, remembering the possibility for practice. And it's it can be such a small but helpful shift from our evaluation of how we think things are going, into our judgment, into our story, into back to what is my intention here? Yeah. That's using the moment for practice. That's bringing ourselves back to each moment as a practice moment. And we can see that when things like loving kindness or practice even are present, even in a seed-like form, even in like a baby seedling form, those also have strong preventative capacities. They also help the unskillful from really taking root. When metta is present, and all the wholesome, skillful states are present, it's more challenging for the unwholesome to take hold. So the last is just to maintain wholesome states that are already present, and these two go together. So we can do this by, again, bringing our insights, bringing our wholesome qualities to mind. Just to say that this is not always easy practice, and sometimes this practice is talked about as really taking in the good. Spending some time with taking in the good, lingering a little bit more with the good and the wholesome than might feel usual or customary. One of my teachers, when I was becoming a teacher, and I would do a lot of assisting, there's this period right after you give a talk, and many people might notice this from your own experiences in places where you're really working on staying present, maybe being vulnerable, open, transparent. I think Brené Brown talks about this as a vulnerability hangover. In places where you perhaps have been open, immediately afterwards, there's this like can be a spasm of contraction, of shame and self-judgment. So when I first started teaching, there would be several teachers who would know that this would come up after people gave talks, maybe for the first time or the first 1,000 times, that afterwards there would be a tendency to get really sucked into self-criticism or judgment. And this teacher would say, just seeing our minds on that ledge of collapse and judgment would say, hey, you know what? We did a good thing today. We did a really good thing today. Yeah, we were sincere in our efforts. We shared the Dharma. Yeah, this is good. This is a good thing. So this taking in the good, both when we encounter it outwardly and recognizing it inwardly, can go against some major habit patterns, but can both prevent us from sliding into unskillful states and can kind of keep us steady and aware in the realm of the wholesome. So another place that this comes up often is that many people will send me photos or write to me about wonderful experiences they've had in practice or how practice has served them in some way. And oftentimes, as a teacher, it's not easy to know kind of how people are doing or the impact that you're having, but I'll often get these kind of reports, sometimes years after I've seen people, and it's so helpful in maintaining a connection to a deep intentionality around practice. It's very easy to skip over those emails in deference to everything that needs to be done and everything that's going wrong and all of that. But to really kind of take in some of the wholesome benefits of the efforts that we put in is an extremely helpful, difficult thing to do. So I want to just end with one of the great antidotes that the Buddha offered in counteracting all of the hindrances. So there are specific kind of efforts that we can make to help balance our energy and effort with each of the hindrances. But in every one, the Buddha includes, with everyone, the Buddha includes good friendship and skillful conversation. In every single one, it is always helpful. It is always helpful for all four of these wise efforts. Yeah. So what we do here in Sangha is no small thing. It doesn't make it immediately better. It doesn't mean we're immediately freed from all of our bad habits. But it does help in each of these categories. Okay, so that was kind of a whirlwind through those four. But hopefully this gives you a sense of the possibilities of an ennobling relationship to effort. Yeah. So wise effort is both balanced and increasingly skillful. So our capacity to meet a wider range of experiences, to harmonize both inside the energy that's available with the requirements outside, grows. And in that, we can feel our own, perhaps more and more of our own innate kind of dignity and nobility. We're less at the mercy of the hindrances, and we're less consumed with managing them. So in that, the real kind of potentials, the brightness, the inherent wakefulness of the heart can shine more fully forward. Yeah. Okay, so why don't we just sit quietly for a moment? That. And you can just notice what's present for you. Okay, so what I'd like to do for the discussion tonight, and thank you for your attention. I hope that this has sparked some of your own reflections. So what I'd like to do for the discussion tonight is have people have a chance to talk with each other a little bit before coming into the larger group. So don't flee mentally or physically. This is one of the most helpful ways that we can encourage each other. So the Buddha said, work out your own awakening with diligence. He said this right as he was passing away. And speaking together is one really profound way that we can both reflect on wise effort and practice it. So think of it as an extension of our meditation, of our cultivation practice. So what we'll do is we'll form groups of three. Okay, so do that in the room, and then online I'll help invite you into rooms also. If you join a room. And what I'd like you to do, we'll just have about 10 minutes. And so make sure that each person has a chance to speak. So take a moment once you're in the group, say hello. Don't launch into chit-chat. Yeah, it's going to be tempting, but just say hello, and then for a moment, kind of fall back into yourself, right? Let your attention go inward for a moment. And the questions I'd like you to reflect on, first of all, is to notice what's more prevalent for you. Is it some kind of inertia or excitement, agitation? Just in terms of our own energetic sense. And obviously we all have both. So, but what's most present for you? And then what is your story about effort? What is the story that you tell about effort? Is it, this is too hard, I'm not up for it, I'm lazy? Is it, I have too much energy, I just need to something? I need to calm down? Is it I don't have enough energy? What are your tendencies around effort? What are your stories around effort? And then if you'd like, describe one wholesome quality about yourself that you notice, either as a result of practice, or just in everyday life, one wholesome quality that you notice. And it may be difficult to name that, but just give that a little bit longer than you might. And what is it like to fully acknowledge that? What is it like to reflect on the wholesome that way? Okay, hopefully that's not too much. Feel free to choose any or choose your own. And so, Kathy, if you'd be open to helping me, or I can help do the breakout rooms. We'll do groups of three, please. Hey, does anyone have any reflections like to share from small groups? Yes. Is that like?
Thanks, Ryan. Thank you for the talk. In my small group, we both were reflecting on how helpful it is to be reminded that this is joyful effort, and that, you know, it's really, for me, easy to remember that when everything is like unfolding beautifully and it's like, oh my God, my relationships are blossoming and everything is, oh, it's great. And then when it's like, man, I feel like I'm just slogging through. And this is hard because I notice every time I'm like unskillful and it's like, oh. And it's like the reminder that even like maybe the noticing, you know, is like part of this like journey, and that that's joyful, and that there's like skillfulness even in being more aware that that's happening. It's easy for me to forget that there's the joy in that too. Yeah. And so that reminder that, you know, that even the noticing, even the starting over, is a joyful effort and leading in one direction that's wholesome is a really helpful reminder. Great.
There's one here.
Hi there. I just want to say our group, it was lovely because it was very, everybody was so open and wholehearted about it, just sincerely engaging and a great, just a nice discussion. Mm-hmm. So that was, felt really good.
Sounds like the wholesome mind states arose. I guess.
I think so.
You weren't calling it that, but I'm getting that drift. Yeah. Yes. Okay, looks like, oh, Emery.
Hi.
Hey.
I tend to have a vulnerability hangover after I share in Sangha, but I'm going to go for it. The part of your talk that I really like recognized was that tension between being with something, being with an emotion, being with some kind of felt experience or mind state, and then getting wrapped up and sucked up into it. And this happened to me recently where I realized that I was really sad about something. And I hadn't really realized that before. I hadn't really called it that, or I called it tiredness, but then I was like, no, I'm not tired of this. I'm really sad about it. Mm-hmm. So then I tried to spend some time just experiencing the sadness and letting it just flow and be. I do believe I had sadness, but it was, and I have it, but it's hard to really feel it without, for me, without getting going on the stories about why I'm sad or what is happening in my life that's making me sad. And then when I go more in that direction of the thinking and the reasons, a whole bunch of resistance comes up to the life circumstance or the situation that's causing the sadness. So I just don't know if you can comment a little bit more about that. It feels like a tricky thing to be with it and experience without getting completely wrapped up in the story and resisting the elements of the story that are causing the sadness or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for that. I think that probably many of us can relate to that. I think we need to experiment with, you know, allowing an emotion fully and noticing how easy it is for thoughts to feed emotions, whatever they are, whether it's sadness, irritability, fear, whatever it might be. And so when we're kind of bringing a full-hearted awareness to it, there is a sense of meeting it, experiencing it. I really like Sayadaw Tejaniya's framing around really experiencing ourselves as nature. So there's a kind of impersonal quality I mentioned at the beginning in the sit, sensing kind of the weather pattern. And so that has a physical component, a whole system bodily component to it, and staying more with that kind of as a natural process. The conditions are in place for sadness to arise. It doesn't mean, often when we're doing that digging and analyzing and trying to figure out, it's like we're trying to use our thinking function to solve the emotion, you know? And so if we look, there's often some aversion to it. Like, I want to crack this. I want to figure this out so that I don't have to experience it.
But if we're right there, kind of in the hot belly of it, it's a really uncomfortable and unpleasant human emotion or experience. But when we have the awareness to meet it, it can become simple, direct, and it doesn't need a lot of the kind of analysis or the spin that really is more, it's less being with it and more trying to crack it in my experience, you know, or getting entangled in the proliferation around it. Yeah. So the emotion in and of itself is nature. It's changing. It's moving on its own. Our body has a lot of capacity to handle that, to integrate that, to allow that to come and allow that to go. So a lot of our work in meeting emotion is giving it the space to be there in its fullness, express itself, without having to kind of understand and dissect and deconstruct it, but to kind of meet it as a natural movement, give it space for it to move. I think for a long time that was really difficult for me too. I thought that being with it meant being embroiled in it. And those are very different. Yeah, those are very different. So, but it does take experimenting. It kind of takes getting it wrong and letting it be a little bit messy before we realize, oh, I'm entangled. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm entangled. So, okay.
Very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that. Yeah. All right, everybody. So I hope this gives you some useful reflections for your own week and your own practice. We want to appreciate all the volunteer help tonight. So thank you, everybody who helped make tonight happen. And with those online, would you like to say goodnight? If you'd like to unmute, just wish everybody well for now.